history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that need to be heard, and we're always better off for taking the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Santa Maria, California with 94-year-old Bob Metauer. And Bob, 94, are you sure? Because I heard you rode 6 miles on your bike this morning.
I was 94 on Tuesday, and my twin sister's the same age.
Funny how that works. And the riding 6 miles this morning, for a lot of 94-year-olds, that would be a big deal. For you, I guess that's nothing. How many miles have you ridden on your bike?
I'm over 94,750 miles.
When are you going to stop? Do you have a goal where you, once you reach it, you're going to quit the bike?
Well, I think good Lord is going to take care of that for me. I really haven't set a date.
Smart man, smart man. I'm sure the folks of Santa Maria have seen you on that bike a time or two around here, and I've even seen some TV clips of that. And if people are listening closely and they have that discerning ear, they might be able to tell you didn't grow up in Santa Maria, that there's a little East Coast to your accent. Where did this Bob Metauer story all begin?
Well, I was born 5 houses inside the New York City limits in a place called Queens Village in the front bedroom. I have a twin sister. We had a German midwife, and she went first, got all the looks and all the brains, and I came in second.
Well, it's going to be tough. I mean, it's radio, so the looks don't matter, but the brains probably do. So we'll hope that this suffices. So growing up in the New York City area during the Great Depression, what were those days like? What are some of the things you remember about your childhood there?
Well, we didn't have any money. You know, it was pretty tough. My father somehow managed to buy a house, and we had a nice house in Queens Village. What I remember most is that when I was 16 years old, I was going to Jamaica High School, and I was a butcher boy. And in those days, the people call up on the phone and ask for some meat, and I would deliver the meat. And I would ride as much as 50 miles on my back on Saturday. I did it all every afternoon and all day Saturday. And for that, I got $12. And I had to give the $12 to my mother because we had to eat. That's the way it was.
Well, and I think of New York during the 20s and 30s, and I think the Bronx Bombers. Were you a baseball fan at all?
Yes, I was. Dodgers and Yankees. Dodgers were there until 1957 when they moved out to L.A., and so were the Giants.
So did you ever get to go to any of those games?
Well, I told you I have 4 daughters, and it was very tough going. It took me a long time to earn enough to pay for all of the things that my family was spending money faster than I could make it. It took me a long time till I could get a few quarters to rub together. And I was able to see 1 Dodger game, 1 Yankee game, and 1 football Giant game.
I'm sure those were memorable occasions, and I think a lot of people were identifying with you when you talked about the money being spent before you made it. So you told me about being the butcher boy and delivering meat and all that, but before the war, before you got out of high school, did you have some ideas of what you wanted to do with your life or where you wanted to go, what kind of work you wanted to do?
No, I had none. It was tough to get a job. Nobody knew where the hell they were going to work. So it was tough to get a job.
What do you remember about December 7th, 1941?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't remember too much, other than the fact December 7th was my father's birthday. But I do remember, that the Japanese bombed, Honolulu and Pearl Harbor and all that. I don't even think it occurred to me that I would be going into the service.
So when did that change? How did you end up in the Navy?
Well, that changed when I got drafted. I graduated after my 18th birthday, so I was drafted, and I had to go to the draft board. And at that time, the Navy was taking a terrible pasting in the Pacific. And my mother said, "Don't you dare go in the Navy," when I was going to the draft board. So I went to the draft board, and they said, "Where do you want to go?" And I said, I want to go in the Army. He said, no, not today. Today you're in the Navy. One of the biggest breaks of my whole life.
But you didn't think so at the time, or just your mother didn't think so at the time?
Well, I don't remember my mother's reaction, but I was certainly happy.
But you had a few hiccups along the way. I understand you had a little issue in boot camp.
Well, that's true. I was in boot camp, and I went to breakfast, and when I finished eating, I tried to get up and couldn't even get up. I had to put my hand in my stomach to support it, and I went to sick bay. It turned out I had appendicitis. They did surgery on me and put me in the hospital, of course, and I was in bed for 7 days during the war. And then after that, I had a month of light duty. Turned out the appendix surgery was a good break for me, too. I wound up in the outgoing unit, and I got to know the first-class petty officer who was responsible for sending people out to different places, different schools and different ships and whatever. So I asked to be a radio man. He said, no, that's congressional appointment. Went down, kept going, and finally I wound up with machinist shop school, and he said, well, you can go there. So I went to Wentworth Institute up in Boston, and we're up there for 4 months. And we marched from the Somerset Hotel to Wentworth Institute, back and forth every day. After the 4 months were over, they sat us down. They said, where do you want to go? And I said, well, I'd like to go into a submarine. Well, I had had surgeries before the appendix, so I was not a candidate for the submarines. You have to be perfect. So my second choice was an aircraft carrier, and that's how I wound up on the Ticonderoga, the aircraft carrier.
And you mentioned a couple things there. You said it was a break that they weren't drafting into the Army the day you went to the draft board, and it was a break that your appendicitis happened when it did. So flesh that out for me. I'm sure you've thought about this a few times. What do you think the other scenarios would have been? Why was that a good break for you?
I have no idea. I have no idea what would have happened otherwise. But I wound up on the Ticonderoga, and I was a plaque owner, and we had to go down to Newport News, Virginia. And there we were loading the ship with supplies and so forth. Then we went on a shakedown cruise. And a shakedown cruise, the purpose of that is to have the crew learn how to maneuver and operate the ship and do all of the functions that has to be done. And at the same time, they launched some planes off the carrier, so the crew got that experience. After that, we came back and loaded up again, and then we went through the Panama Canal, and we went to San Diego, and there we loaded up again. We were in San Diego, and while we were there, we were off out in the ocean a little ways and launching planes. And one of the planes had some problems, and it ditched into the ocean. So back on land, they sent a PBY out to take a look at what happened to the crew, and the commander said, the weather's pretty rough out there, so don't land. Just come back and report what you see. Well, when they went out there, they looked at the pilots were in a raft, and they saw that one of them was pretty badly injured. So they landed the plane and picked up the crew. When they got back to shore, the commander threw the pilot into the brig because he disobeyed orders. Well, Dixie Kiefer was the commander of the Ticonderoga. When he found out about that, he had a fit, and he went to that commander and said, you know, you get that young man out of the brig in a hurry. And that's what happened.
Because he disobeyed orders, but he probably saved that pilot's life by doing it.
Could be. After that, we loaded up the plane. The ship was filled up with planes and on flight deck and all of that. And then we were on our way to Pearl Harbor.
And a lot of people listening probably haven't been on an aircraft carrier, certainly not an Essex-class carrier from World War II. Was it a little eye-opening to get aboard that ship and see how massive it was and how a giant an operation it really was?
Well, it was the largest aircraft carrier in the world at that time. We had a crew of over 3,000 people, and yes, you know, it was amazing. And of course, you know, you're young, so you just go ahead and do what you have to do.
And everybody has a little different role among that 3,000-man crew. So what was yours? What were your duties on the ship?
Well, I started out in the hydraulic gang, and that was steering gear, anchor windlass, and the elevators that moved the plane from the hangar deck to the flight deck. And I was in the number one elevator pump room, which was way forward, way down in the bilge. And my job there was, when they blew flight quarters, my job was to go down into the pump room and push a button, wait till the pressure got high, open up a valve, and then call up topside and tell them we're ready to go. And they were kind enough to call me in when I talked to them. They said, well, come on up. So I ran all the way from the bilge all the way up to the flight deck, and on the starboard side, the controls for the forward elevator were on the side of the flight deck, and we stood in gratings, looked down through where you look through to the water, and that was how they operated with the buttons on the side of the elevator. The ship was loaded with planes, so they couldn't take off by themselves, so they had to be catapulted off. And when they catapulted the planes off, the wing would go right over our head as we were standing there.
I bet that's an experience nothing prepares you for.
No, that's right. It's quite exciting, really. And then they didn't just go, they didn't go right off. They dipped down and went down, and fortunately, there was 60 feet from the flight deck to the water. And they would probably go down to almost touch the water before they would have speed to go on up.
So you're aboard this ship, brand new ship. You just told us what your original role was. What about your first experience with what war's really like? Your first taste of an enemy to deal with?
Well, on January 21st in 1945... We had just finished bombing Saigon, so we're down there, and we were coming out to go back to another assignment. We were coming out, we're between the Philippines and Formosa, when we took two kamikazes. And my role there was, they blew general quarters, of course, and my role was to go to the forward mess hall. That was my battle station. And when we got there, the place was full of water up to your knees. And so the first thing we had to do was to get the hatch closed where the water was coming down from the flight deck. And having done that, then we were okay. And we were communicating with battle control. So battle control told us to get out of there and move to another compartment, which we did, and was dry there. And by this time, with smoke all over the place, the smoke was being brought in by the blowers that would normally air the place, and we had to put on our gas mask, and the lights were out, so that's where we were. And then battle control told us they lost contact with the compartment behind where we originally were, and asked us to go in there and see what was going on. So I think I was one of the first ones that went in, and there was a gentleman, was a chow hall. So this gentleman was sitting there with a pen light flashlight in his hand, and it was on. So I thought he was okay, and I went and picked up one of the other people and took him down to sick bay because they were overcome. They had no gas mask on. I went back into the compartment. That guy was still sitting there with the flashlight. So I said, you better get out of here, and he was out cold. So I took him to sick bay.
And when you say take him to sick bay, you had to carry him?
Yes. And then on the second trip, I heard his voice, and it was Eddie Mazur, my best friend. We both worked in the machine shop, and we made weights. He was a body specimen, and we made weights, and I had set aside an apartment up forward above the flight, the hangar deck. And when they blew general quarters, he was coming down the ladder when the first plane went through the flight deck and exploded in the hangar deck and made a piece of charcoal out of Eddie. It was terrible to see.
Well, as I was listening to you describe this, I'm thinking all of this was terrible to see. And what prepares you for that? I mean, you're a 20-year-old kid. Had you guys even experienced anything like this before? Had you seen other ships get hit by kamikazes? Did you know that threat was there?
No, I never saw it, but we knew the threat because we had heard about it.
In fact, 2 months earlier, the Ticonderoga's gun crews had shot down a would-be kamikaze that landed in the water just outside her starboard bow. That same day, another kamikaze from the same wave of attackers did strike the USS Lexington, killing 47 men. You can find photos of that January 21st, 1945 attack and the damage those two suicide planes did at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And pretty soon, you're going to be able to see Bob's face on a banner above the streets of Santa Maria, California. It's not affiliated with this program, even though the name Hometown Heroes is the same, but the American Legion, VFW, and Parks and Recreation Department in Santa Maria have teamed up to honor local veterans in a very visible and fitting manner. Bob's banner will go up in January and remain on display until June, thanks to his neighbor, Jim Pate, who nominated him and also introduced him to me so we could introduce him to you today. When we come back, more about that day, January 21st, 1945, what a 20-year-old sailor experienced and how he helped others in need. 94-year-old Bob Mettauer of Santa Maria, California is our guest today, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's
800-538-3328. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to learn about the Big T, the aircraft carrier USS Ticonderoga. From one of that giant ship's last surviving plank owners, 94-year-old Bob Mettauer of Santa Maria, California, originally from New York. Before the break, he talked about January 21st, 1945. When his carrier was hit by not just one, but two Japanese kamikazes. He described helping some incapacitated sailors to safety, but there was nothing he could do for his best friend, Eddie Mazur, who was burned so badly that there was no chance to help him survive. Mazur was the youngest of 12 children and broke track and field records at New Kensington Vocational High School in Pennsylvania. He was strong enough to walk on his hands, and you heard Bob talk about how Eddie used to use him as a barbell. According to an online tribute posted by Eddie's nephew, Fred, Mazur was also a talented artist who could sketch pencil portraits of people. I have that tribute page complete with a photo of Edward J. Mazur linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Bob Mettauer has never had the chance to talk to any of his friends surviving relatives, but we've started the ball rolling on that and hope to have an update to share soon. Bob's memories of that day and of his late friend are still incredibly clear 73 years later.
You know, the experience of seeing Eddie, it was immediately I knew there was nothing I could do. So I had to continue doing what I was doing to help the other people. And I still remember that. That'll never leave me.
And this was the guy that you'd spent a lot of time with, that you were probably with just the day before?
Yes, we were in the machine shop. We used to do things together. What he did was he made me cross my arms and cross my legs, and he'd pick me up and press me like I was a weight. That was the kind of a specimen he was. Wonderful young man.
So you come into that hold, that room, and you see him burnt to a crisp. You know he's already gone.
Yes, I knew it. And actually, he's listed as missing in action in this in my book.
I wonder if that's ever been corrected.
I have no way of knowing. But I knew when I saw him, I knew he wasn't missing any action. He was doomed.
And what do you do in a situation like that? I'm sure there's a lot of emotions that come over you, but you're still expected to perform a job.
Exactly. That's just exactly what it was. And there I was helping people out of the other compartment. I just continued to do that. And then, of course, pretty soon, things calmed down, and they told us to go back to our original location, which was, in my case, was a machine shop. And on the way back there, myself and Thompson, who was walking with me, we found my friend Chuck Lodge, and he was without his gas mask. It had expired, and he was having real problems. So he and I, we used my gas mask back and forth so that he could get some fresh air until we got back to the machine shop. And when we got to the machine shop, it looked like nothing had happened at all. It was amazing.
And somewhere in there, there was another job that you ended up with, a pretty gruesome task to help some other sailors who had been injured. What about the bigger picture? I mean, as this is happening, you talk about the smoke everywhere. You're seeing some of the damage to shipmates, including your best friend who's killed. Are you wondering if your ship's going to make it? If you guys might even be sunk by this attack?
No, there was never any threat of that. We weren't worried about that at all.
Even though you got hit by two kamikazes?
Right. Well, he didn't damage the hull. You know, the ship itself was intact. All they did was damage the flight deck. So the ship was intact, so there was nothing to worry about.
And maybe before we get to your job of prying these rings off of guys whose hands are burned, maybe you can explain to us where those kamikazes hit on the ship and the extent of the damage. I know you've got some photos in this book that you shared with high school kids before, but for our listeners, paint that picture of where the planes hit and the damage that occurred.
Well, at that time, I had no idea. It wasn't until afterwards that I was able to go up topside and find out what happened. So I had no idea. But one of them went through the flight deck. It was forward of the island and on the starboard side. Went right through the flight deck and exploded in the hangar deck. And the other one hit the fire control turret on the island just above where Dixie Kiefer, our skipper, was, and injured him pretty badly, so he had to be taken off the ship.
In fact, in your book, which they produced right at the end of the war, there's a picture of the skipper of the ship, Dixie Kiefer, with a microphone in his hand in a hospital bed and people all around him. What was happening there?
Well, he was so badly injured, they were taking him off to put him on a hospital ship. And he was saying farewell to his crews and keep up the good work and all of that. And there wasn't a dry eye on that ship when he left. He was such a fine man, great leader. And he became a world hero, a national hero.
Well, and you say there wasn't a dry eye on the ship. So I'm wondering, where were you while that was happening? And were you hearing this come over the PA system?
Yeah, I was down in the machine shop. I was down there when it happened. He came over the PA system, and everybody on his ship could hear him. And it was amazing because he was just a wonderful person, a wonderful leader.
Yeah, and I guess, and again, we're bouncing back and forth here a little bit, but I'm just thinking, if I'm a 20-year-old kid and I've just been through all this, the damage to the ship, knowing how many guys were killed, including my best friend, and then I hear my skipper get on the PA knowing that he's been wounded and he's getting carried off. Did what he had to say help you process the situation you were in or motivate you for what you were going to be dealing with?
Well, to be honest, we were prepared for anything anyway. And the problem was when he was replaced, it just changed the entire attitude on the ship. Everything was different. The morale was different, and the person that took his place was not nearly the man that Dixie Kiefer was. Not nearly the man that Dixie Kiefer was.
Well, let's talk some more about January 21st. So you told us some of what you experienced that day, and I'm sure it felt like a pretty long day. I think they hit you around noon, is that right?
Yeah, it was early in the day, yes.
So for the next several hours, it was probably nonstop action and busyness for you?
Well, it didn't, you know, really it didn't last that long, you know, because it happened so fast, and we were able to straighten everything out and get the fires out, and I would say probably an hour, that's all. And by that time, we were back in the machine shop.
And there's a book. You mentioned your daughter found a book where she works, the USS Ticonderoga book that has a lot of firsthand accounts from the men of the ship in there, and yours is in there. And there's something that you don't mention, but if I flip a few guys further and find Vern Rampa's account, he talks about a pretty gruesome assignment that the two of you had to carry out. What happened there?
Well, we received a phone call from sick bay about the men, some of the men that had, their hands were severely burned, and the ring was still on their finger, and it was killing them, the pain. So they called us up and asked if there's anything we could do. So my chief, Vern Rampa, said, yeah, let's send them up. So they sent us to the machine shop. And what I had a rag full of cold water and a long-nosed pair of pliers. And I had to dig deep into the wound, the burn, and lift that ring out so that Vern Rampa could grind it and cut it in half and we could take it off. And I think we did five or six of them.
And you had to do this, because if you don't do that, they're going to lose those ring fingers. But what were those guys going through? I mean, are they screaming in pain? Are they gritting their teeth? And what did that feel like for you to be sticking those pliers in there?
Well, they were men, you know. They weren't crying. They knew we were trying to do the job, and that's what we did. And you know what? It doesn't take long before you become a man when you're in the service. And that's what happens. You know, we're no longer kids, we're men.
And I know this is a little extraneous, but I'm thinking there might be some wives out there who are saying, well, did they save those wedding rings or did they get rid of them?
I have no idea what happened to them.
Wasn't a priority at that point, huh?
No, not at all.
And you mentioned that during this whole time, you still haven't seen the damage that those kamikazes inflicted. When you did, when you got topside and you saw with your own eyes the aftermath, the damage, the devastation, what was that like for you?
Well, of course, you know, I was amazed, but by that time, it was all over. Now there you go again, you know. You're men, you just have to go around and do what you have to do to take care of everything and make sure everything goes back to normal, and that's what we did.
Did you do something to recognize or honor or memorialize the guys who had been killed?
Well, the people were killed. There's nothing we could do for them. So they had a ceremony, and it was nothing we could do. We had nothing that we could do for the poor dead people. And who knew how long we were going to stay out at sea? Nobody knew that. So they had a program where they buried them at sea. And they covered them up, and they just, they were in a stretcher or something like that, and they tilted the stretcher, and the poor boys went overseas into the ocean, and it was not a very pleasant thing to see.
Well, and you've already told us your best friend was one of them, but is there also part of you that, where it registers, hey, that could be me that they're dropping into the water?
Well, of course, it's, you know, that could have happened to anybody. Fortunately, I was down below decks, and I didn't have any problems at all, personally. Of course, I told you the story about what we had to do.
So that's January 21st of 45, and there's still another 7 months of the war in front of you. You mentioned that kind of the atmosphere of the ship changed after the change in command. But what about your role on the ship? Did that change? Did your duties stay the same, or did you move into something else?
Well, what happened there was when we got back to, we had to be repaired, and we went back out, and we were off the coast of Japan bombing Tokyo when the atom bombs were dropped. And right after that, we toured the coast of Japan before the actual surrender. And when the Japanese surrendered, we docked in Yokohama, and I had read the book Unbroken, and in Unbroken it said that the prisoners of war that had been in the Japanese prison camps and treated like terribly, they were taking the train to Yokohama, and I actually was allowed to go in the docks of Yokohama. And while we were there, we picked up 500 who I assume were prisoners of war to take them back to the States.
And they must not have looked very good.
Well, actually, they were in the hangar deck, and I really never even saw them.
And you're talking about your planes bombing Japan in the days leading up to the surrender, and even really up to and past the surrender, probably. They're still flying sorties and bombing Japan. And that makes me wonder, you had all these pilots on your ship this whole time you're there. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of planes that are taken off. How did you guys, the ship's crew, get along with those Navy flyers?
We never saw them. Now, they were in a different area. They were in a different area for the officers and the pilots, and when I was down below decks, I never saw them. But I did. I did enjoy watching. I used to go up on the island and watch the planes come in, and I saw many barrier crashes and all kinds of crazy things. And I think I told you about watching the planes take off with the planes going over my head, and that gave me the desire to try to fly an airplane.
So what'd you do with that desire?
First of all, I had my four daughters through college. And then I started to have a couple of nickels together, and I worked for the telephone company, and they started a telephone company employees flying club. And I was involved with that, and we flew out of Long Island MacArthur, and I learned how to fly a four-seat Cessna Skyhawk, which was, the identity was November 15,000. And we used to call, when we called the tower, we say that's November 15,000, and they would shorten it to 000, so it didn't take so long over the radio.
But you didn't have to take off and land from a carrier anyway.
No. As I say, I had my four girls through college before I could do this.
Well, and for your four girls to exist, you had to make it through the war, which obviously you did. And I'm just thinking, if you get kamikazed in January of 45, and I know it's two or three more months that they're repairing the ship before you guys go back out, but when you did go back out, was there that fear or concern or awareness that what happened before could happen again?
No, we knew that Japan was licked, and we did go out, and as I said before, we bombed Tokyo 11 days in a row before they dropped the atom bombs. But they lost all their experienced pilots, and the way they had a few left, and what they did was this kamikaze business, they had a good pilot. And they had a bunch of kids that could take the plane up and follow their leader. And when he got them to the task force, he told them that they knew that they had to go and fly right into one of the vessels in the task force. By that time, there was no more air battles or anything like that. They were beat.
But if you've heard other sailors who were in the Pacific during this time period, you know the enemy wasn't always the only hazard. What does Bob recall about the infamous Typhoon Cobra, also known as Halsey's Typhoon? We'll explore that when we come back. Don't forget to check out the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 94-year-old Bob Mettauer of Santa Maria, California, where quite a few folks recognize him as Bicycle Bob. That's even been the subject of a local television feature I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Another video you'll find there has Bob showing you something he brought back from his time aboard the USS Ticonderoga, something he made in the aircraft carrier's machine shop that you wouldn't be able to find anywhere else. Much of our interview today has focused on a few hours at the start of 1945 and an attack that left more than 100 of his shipmates killed or wounded. The ship's captain, Dixie Kiefer, was injured, and Bob's best friend, Eddie Mazur, was among those who lost their lives. So, as far as you experienced it firsthand, that January 21st of 45 was the only time you really had a scare?
Exactly. No problems after that.
But the enemy is one thing, and the weather's something else. And I understand your ship had to navigate through not just the famous typhoon, Halsey's typhoon in December of 44, but maybe even another typhoon as well. Do you remember some of those weather conditions you faced?
Oh, I do. It was actually amazing. The waves, I went up topside. The island had a hatchway that you could go out onto the flight deck. And I actually went up there and stood on the flight deck and saw these, what I call liquid mountains. They were so strong and so big that on several of the aircraft carriers that were in the task force, it actually bent the corners of the flight deck, just bent them right up, and they were supported by a 6-foot I-beam. But that never didn't happen to the Ticonderoga. We were very fortunate.
That's got to be a little scary, though, to look up. You say a liquid mountain, and that liquid mountain's about to crash over the deck of the ship.
Well, of course, but I would, that's why I went up to see it, and it was pretty exciting. I don't know, whether when they have hurricanes in the East Coast, whether waves were that big, but they sure were big there.
And I'm sure that wherever you were on that ship, you were feeling it a little bit.
Oh, yes. But I always say it was like riding in a Cadillac. Because destroyers of the water is breaking over the ship and all of that kind of stuff, and we're kind of just going through all of it because we're so big.
What about the guys that you served with? I mean, you've mentioned a couple names there, but just generally speaking, how did you all get along, and what did you come to appreciate about the kind of people they were?
For instance, there was one guy that didn't change his clothes. He was dirty. Somebody threw him in the shower. But for the most part, everybody got along well. But the biggest problem, we went as long as 8 months without seeing land. And here you are in this vehicle, the ship. You can only go so far. And the nights, the days were okay because you had something to do. But the evenings were terrible, and most of the guys took their money out and gambled. But I was fortunate enough to be next to this, my friend Vern Ramper, and he invited me into the machine shop. And I spent my evenings in the machine shop, and I was learning how to use the lathes and the milling machines and all that. And one day the division officer came over to me and said, "How would you like to work in the machine shop?" And boy, did I jump at that. Because my job in the elevator pump room was boring. All we did was scrape gratings and clean bilges and stuff like that. So the machine shop was a very, very good upgrade.
Your planes are bombing Tokyo right on up to Japan's surrender. When the news came that Japan had surrendered, and I've seen in your diary where you wrote it down at the time, but what was it like on that giant aircraft carrier when that news came to 3,000 men?
Well, it's really it's really funny. There was a big cheer, and then it lasts about 20 seconds, and you realize you weren't going anywhere. You were still going to be there. So it was a big cheer, and then that was it. You knew you were going to be on that ship for many more months. So that was about the best of it.
And you would be on that ship for many more months, and you guys did several trips bringing troops back from the Pacific?
Well, what happened is when we got in, they took all of the planes off, and they converted the hangar deck into a bedroom, and they put these pipe racks all the way from the top to the bottom, floor to the ceiling, and they had about 10 bunks high, and we carried about 3,000 sailors or prisoners of war or whatever back to the States. They were allowed 2 meals a day because the kitchen wasn't built to feed so many people, so they were allowed 2 meals a day. And we went out 3 times. And after the 3rd time, I was preserving the machinery in the machine shop when I was finally discharged.
And what did that feel like to come back to America to see your mom and dad and twin sister again? Were there ever days out at sea where you wondered if that would ever happen?
Of course. We always had that in mind, you know. But when we got back, I told them that I had purchased a car, and they would give us a penny and a half for a mile for train tickets, and they didn't charge us anything. So we wound up with about $150 traveling across country. And I stopped in Chicago and bought myself a Easter outfit, a suit.
And was it different? Was life in America different after that? I mean, war had been the reality for more than 4 years, and now all of a sudden it's over. Did you notice a difference maybe just in your own outlook?
You know, now you're in a position where you have to take care of yourself again. I was trying to get a job. I was setting pins in a bowling alley. I was caddying $5 for doubles. That's a bag on each shoulder and 18 holes for $5. Finally, my wife and I were married now, too, by the way, and neither one of us had a job. I went after a job in a telephone company. Well, what happened, it was interesting there because we had to go to Brooklyn, and they had this huge room with these tables all across the room, rows of them. They had dividers between where each person sat. They lined us all up and put us in these chairs. And there was somebody up in front of the room. He said, "Now, there's a device there on your table, and we'd like you to take it apart." So I thought, well, they're going to want me to put it together. And they timed you. I took it apart and laid everything orderly. And they said, "Okay, now put it together." And they were timing us. So put it together. And I put it together faster than I took it apart. That made me an installer. It was like going in the army as a sergeant, and I was going to make $42 a week, and the other guys that didn't get installers, they became linemen, climbing poles, and they made $33 a week. So that little scheme cost gave me $9 more a week.
A couple things come to mind. One, I mean, it's been a long time. I mean, we're talking 73 years now since the end of World War II. Have you ever gone to any ship's reunions for the Ticonderoga?
Yes, we did. My wife received a phone call, and it was from a man that was helping to try to organize a group, a veterans group. He said to my wife, "Is it possible your husband was in the Navy during World War II? And she said, "Yes." "Is it possible that he served aboard the USS Ticonderoga?" She said, "Yes." And he said to her, "Wonderful." He said, "My name is Harold Crane, but," he says, "I changed my name. It used to be Krinowitz." And she says, "Oh, Stinky Krinowitz." And that's how we got involved with the Veterans Association, and we're all over the place, and they still do it today. But I don't go any longer because there's nobody I know anymore. They're all gone.
Well, and one of the reasons I asked about the reunions, I was wondering if you ever encountered any of those guys whose fingers you saved by getting their rings off.
I don't think I ever did.
Have you ever wondered what happened to them and how their lives turned out?
No, I knew they were okay. You know, they you should have seen the expression on their face when those rings came off.
Relief or pain?
Relief and pain.
Well, and the other thing that I have to ask you about, and I understand maybe it's not something that's easy to talk about, but your friend Eddie Mazur, I'm sure that experience as a 20-year-old is not something that anything could prepare you for. But in all the years since, have you ever thought, what would Eddie have done with his life? What kind of a human being, what kind of an American would he have been?
Well, I knew what kind of American he was and what kind of a human he was. But I'm sure he was pretty clever. I'm sure he would have made a fine living for himself.
And pretty strong, it sounds like, too.
Yes, he was.
I'm guessing he's the only one who's ever lifted you up over his shoulders like a barbell?
As far as I know. But I can tell you this, that I used to do it with my daughters. I have four daughters.
I'm sure Eddie would have been proud of that. And, you know, he's one of the more than 406,000 Americans who lost their lives in World War II. That's so long ago and so far away, and for most of the people listening, before they were even born. So what do we need to know about those men? How should they be remembered today?
Well, I think everybody remembers them the same way. They were all heroes. They were all heroes. Even today, I wear my World War II cap, and I have people come over to me and say thank you for your service. Actually, it's usually the senior citizens or the older people. The younger people, they don't. The World War II is not a part of their lives.
Well, maybe if they're listening right now, it will be, and I'll jump on board and say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling your story to all of us today. Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you think we ought to know?
I told you before that I learned how to, when I saw the airplanes catapulted off, I got the desire to fly. And it got to the point where I was able to pay all the bills with my family was, you know, they were making money, spending money fast I could make it. And at that time, they started a telephone employees flying club. I worked for a telephone company, and I was able to learn how to fly an airplane, which I was pretty proud of.
As well you should be. And what about this bicycling thing? I mean, you told me almost 95,000 miles that you've calculated on two wheels. Where did that come from?
Well, at that particular time, I was still married to my first wife, and she bought me a bike. And I lived down by the golf course, and I started a route over there. I had about 1,500 miles on the bike when she left me. I came up here to Casa Grande, the mobile home park, and then I just, after breakfast every day, I went out and rode a bike. And I used to ride a lot more than I do now. I used to do 20, 25 miles on a day. Now I do 50 miles a week. But it all accumulates.
Yeah, and it keeps you young. I guess I've got to ask you, though, since you have a lot of experience with both, what do you think's more dangerous, being in the Pacific during World War II on an aircraft carrier or riding your bike on a California street?
Riding my bike on a California streets. No doubt about it. I don't even go out in the streets anymore. I live in the mobile home park, and I stay inside so I don't get involved with some of the crazies that are out there.
Well, I guess I've got to ask you this too, Bob, because I know that you're looking forward, and you're in great shape, and you're going to be riding that bike for a long time. But if you look in the rearview mirror a little bit, and you think about 94 years now, what would you say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I always say the finest time of my life was when I was married and all these little baby girls started showing up. No doubt in my mind that was the finest time of my life. I did lose my first wife, and I married another lady here, right here in the park, and she was a perfect partner. And she got pancreatic cancer. So it only lasted 8 years.
But the memories last forever. Memories of a late wife. Memories of a best friend killed in action. Memories of an aircraft carrier on which, as he told us, he became a man. What a privilege to hear some of Bicycle Bob Mettower's memories today. Take a look at the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where we're going to update you as soon as Bob is able to finally connect after all these years with the family of that best friend he lost on the USS Ticonderoga. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all a reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses going to your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.